Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. Families torn apart. We find out more about the devastating human consequences of raids on workplace by US immigration enforcement officials to seek out and arrest illegal immigrants. Changing identities. Britain's ambassador to Italy talks to us about the changing nature of European identities and a new survey among young people showing some surprising findings. And papal audience. Pope Benedict continues his catechesis on the teachings of St. Paul the Apostle at his weekly general audience. In the US, families are being torn apart. Literally, during raids on workplaces by immigration enforcement officials. That's how critics describe the devastating impact of workplace raids to seek out illegal immigrants that have increased dramatically over the past 2 years. In some of these raids, even nursing mothers have been separated from their babies. Foremost amongst those critics is the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. It describes the humanitarian cost of these workplace raids as immeasurable and unacceptable in a civilized society. And it has asked the immigration enforcement authorities to drop the use of such raids. Over the past year or so, the US Department of Homeland Security has stepped up these raids by targeting employers who hire undocumented workers, using force to enter work sites and arrest immigrant employees. During the process of these raids, US citizen children have been separated from their parents. Immigrants arrested have not been afforded the rights of due process, and local communities have been left to cope with the aftermath, including trying to alleviate the suffering of immigrant families torn apart by these raids. Donald Kerwin is director of the Catholic Legal Immigration Network in the US and is among those who have urged the US government to halt workplace raids as an immigration enforcement tool. I began by asking him whether there had been any response from the authorities to this appeal.
We haven't had any direct response. We've asked them to review this as a tactic with an eye towards abandoning it. But the response that we've received indirectly is that they would continue to carry out the raids and to enforce the laws as they see fit.
Why are you so against these raids? What, in your view, are, shall we say, the humanitarian costs of them?
Well, what we've seen throughout the country in the communities where they've taken place is the destruction of those communities, the separation of parents from their children. I mean, people have basically had to abandon their homes. They've had to live together. Children have been taken from school. Businesses have closed. So it's not just an issue of an impact on undocumented people themselves. It's an impact on their families and on the communities as a whole. And they've been very, very devastating in those places.
Now, how often are these raids being carried out, and are they increasing in number?
They've definitely increased. You can't predict exactly when they're going to happen, of course, but they've increased in frequency. They've certainly increased in size, and the numbers of people that have been arrested and not just put in deportation proceedings, but also criminally prosecuted has increased significantly over the last year.
And do we have any idea in terms of total numbers, say, over a year?
Yeah, I mean, for example, in 2004, not very long ago, 685 people were arrested in immigration raids, and of those, 160 people were criminally charged. Already this year, 3,900 have been arrested, and more than 1,000 have been criminally charged, mostly for offenses that go hand-in-hand with these people being in undocumented status in the United States and working illegally. So, I mean, offenses like document fraud, use of a false social security number, those kinds of offenses. These were traditionally treated as civil offenses, but the government has significantly ratcheted up enforcement of the laws by starting to prosecute people. In fact, what usually happens is they charge them an aggravated crime and force them to plead to something less, to accept a small criminal sentence, and after that, they'll then deport them from the United States. So that's a fairly significant ratcheting up of the enforcement that they're doing. It's basically criminalizing people's work.
And what do you think are the reasons behind this? I mean, why are they increasingly turning to this tactic of these raids?
I think what happened was that with the collapse of immigration legislation in the summer of 2007, the Bush administration felt that it was denied a political victory on what was a priority issue for it for its first several years in office. The president was very committed to reform, and he had some very positive things to say throughout most of his tenure about the kind of country that he wanted, about immigrant families, and about matching willing workers with willing employers. It's true that enforcement-related programs were in place and growing, but there was a recognition by the administration that immigration needed to be dealt with comprehensively and even bilaterally, and that the enforcement-only type of approach couldn't possibly work. So what happened was, after the collapse of very imperfect legislation, but legislation that at least tried to deal with the immigration challenge more comprehensively, the administration started to say that the American people had spoken and that they wanted rigorous enforcement of the laws. And they started to provide that in ways that go beyond what anybody expected. I think the administration is still rhetorically committed to significant, positive, comprehensive reform. For the short term, they've ratcheted up an enforcement approach that they've recognized from the start couldn't possibly be successful. And its impact has been quite devastating.
Can you describe some of the worst incidents there have been, some of the most devastating consequences for these immigrants caught up in these raids? Do you have any anecdotes there?
Well, we've tracked cases of parents separated from their children. They've adopted protocols subsequently that allows sole caregivers to be released, but they're released with ankle bracelets. So these are typically mothers that are picked up in raids, sometimes nursing mothers even. During the first set of these raids, they were actually put on planes and sent to southern United States, put in detention centers there, even while they were nursing. So, I mean, there were some terrible stories. Immigration Service, the Department of Homeland Security, has now adopted protocols to make sure that if they're the sole caregiver, that's not going to happen. But nonetheless, there's still significant separation of parents from children. I mean, basically, what we're seeing in communities around the country is hundreds of immigrant families have lost a primary breadwinner, have lost kind of the ability to live with their family intact, and are turning to the Catholic Charities programs for basic survival services for rent, money for medicine, for diapers, for food, for transportation, for, you know, just basically the what they need to survive. And so it's quite devastating.
You said earlier that you believe that one of the reasons why the immigration authorities are increasingly turning to this tactic of raids is because it could be seen as being popular with the American public. Is that actually true? Is that being borne out by surveys?
I'm not sure. I think that there are certain people that take a very ideological approach to the fact that there's undocumented people in the United States, and they regard it as an offense to the rule of law in the United States, and they would like whatever tough tactics the government wants to introduce. They would like the government to very aggressively enforce the laws and to make the laws even stricter than they are. But I think that generally, when people see the human consequences, particularly on people that are self-sacrificing, hardworking, family-oriented people, when they get a sense of the human cost, they turn away from those very, very harsh tactics. And most of the surveys have showed fairly consistently most of the American public, not on the kind of far ends of the debate, but most of the American public want this situation resolved in some kind of a comprehensive way. and recognize that that's going to have to involve provisions that would allow a significant percentage of hardworking, undocumented people to earn the right to remain in the country.
As you said before, the Bush administration had wanted to carry out this comprehensive immigration reform, yet that wasn't possible. Where does the blame lie, in your view, for this failure to enact this, shall we say, comprehensive reform that is so badly needed?
We know that there was a very ferocious lobbying campaign, grassroots lobbying campaign, against what was termed an amnesty program, inaccurately termed an amnesty program, because it was offered to people, or it would have been offered to people, who basically, you know, met several criteria, including work in the United States, ability to speak English, there were good moral character requirements, and several other pretty strict requirements over a number of years. And these people wouldn't have been put in the front of the line, but they'd been put in the very back of the line in terms of people that would be eligible to legalize their status in the United States. So it really wasn't a giveaway program, a forgiveness program. It was basically allowing people here to earn the right over several years to remain and to get on a path to legal status. So it was mischaracterized. There was a very rabid grassroots campaign against it. The proposal was vilified, talk radio shows, Fox News, and in other places in the United States. And that's why it failed. And, you know, unfortunately, we're dealing with the aftermath of that right now. And the problem is not getting any better. The situation of the undocumented is getting worse, but the need for a solution is even greater than it was. So I think what you're going to have is you have both presidential candidates recognizing that, and hopefully they'll turn to it, either McCain or Obama, early on in their administration.
But how much has the issue of immigration featured in this presidential campaign? Because there seems to be an awful lot of emphasis on the character, on the personality, the background of the candidates, and not a lot on, shall we say, the nitty-gritty of the key issues.
Yeah, I think it hasn't come up much in the campaign. Certainly advocates have tried to introduce it into the campaign, but it's regarded by the political people in both campaigns as a radioactive issue, is an issue that it doesn't serve them, either candidate, particularly well to raise. It is clear that the Republican Party platform is a little bit stricter and emphasizes enforcement. It even talks about the fact that perhaps enforcement of existing laws could reduce and even reverse illegal immigration, which is quite questionable, actually. But it doesn't embrace the strategy of raids and prosecutions, the very strategy that we're faced with now. The Democratic platform, it calls for comprehensive immigration reform in the very first year of the new administration to include increased family-based visas, which is quite important, going to assure that there's not this same problem years from now, and a legalization program for undocumented people who are in the United States. So neither of the platforms embraces exactly the tactics that the Bush administration has resorted to.
When it comes to the role of the Catholic Church in this debate over immigration reform and how to deal with the issue of undocumented migrants, what guidelines is the Church calling for?
The Church has called fairly consistently for comprehensive immigration reform that has three or four parts. One is obviously a earned legalization program for undocumented people in the United States, not for everybody, but for people who work, have good moral character, who learn English, and who meet other requirements. So that's one pillar of the Church's position. The second is that there needs to be reform of the legal immigration laws as they exist, because they don't meet the needs for family reunification, and they don't meet the economic needs of the United States, so that the system of legal immigration has to be reformed and has to be brought in line with family needs and the need for laborers in the United States. And then the third point is that the laws do have to be enforced. The Church isn't in favor of open borders, but they have to be enforced humanely, and they can only be enforced successfully, the Church believes, if these other two pillars are taken care of. So I think that that's pretty consistently been the policy position of the Church. And of course, those positions are based on longstanding principles of Catholic teaching related to human rights and the common good and welcoming the stranger.
That was Donald Kerwin, director of the Catholic Legal Immigration Network.
Family, my family.
Identities in transition. Who do we want to be? Is there a crisis of identity in today's multi-ethnic societies? And how do young people in Italy and Britain feel about immigration and politicians in their respective countries? These were just some of the questions that were discussed during the past weekend at the annual Pontignano Conference near Siena in Italy. This conference brings together British and Italian politicians, business people, academics, journalists, and other opinion formers. This year, the conference focused on the changing nature of European identities and the key relationships that will shape the future. The participants were presented with the results of a new survey of 2,000 young adults in Britain and Italy that provided an illuminating snapshot of what young people think about the various themes under discussion. Edward Chaplin is the British ambassador to Italy, and he spoke to me shortly before the conference got underway.
I mean, I think it is a fact that there have been many pressures which affect people's sense of national identity. And you can see that quite clearly in the results of the opinion poll that we commissioned amongst young Italians and British. So that the pressures of, for example, massive flows of migration, the pressures of globalisation and other factors have weakened a sense of national identity. And so what the conference is addressing is the question of what is our sense of national identity, both within nation states and both within Europe and Europe's place in the world, and the other themes that flow from that.
When it comes to what is our sense of identity, do you think now we identify more closely with our own country, with Europe, or do you think there's increasingly a globalised feel to people's sense of where they belong now?
Well, I think, again, look at the results of the opinion poll. I think British young people in particular do feel a sense of national identity. The nation state remains for them the fundamental unit of identity. But at the same time, it's interesting to note that they recognise that the problems, the challenges which any government has to face today can't be faced alone by a nation state, but have to be faced at a European level or even in a wider organisation. So I think it's a mixture. And it's exactly what makes it so interesting to debate.
Now, this survey that you carried about among young people in Italy and Britain, it showed that only about 2 to 3% of these young people had a lot of faith in the governments and the political parties. This is a very low percentage. Do you think governments should be worried about this and see it as a wake-up call?
I think it was 2 to 3 out of 10, so 20 to 30% rather than 2 to 3%. Wasn't quite that low, but it is striking that the faith that young people have in political institutions, the traditional ones of political parties and government, and even in some cases trade unions, is a good deal lower than their faith in other institutions such as the armed forces, or in the case of Italy, the presidency of the Republic. I think politicians in both our countries have been worried for a while about this distance opening up between particularly young people and the political process. So yes, I think they are worried about it.
And coming to the question of immigration, both Italy and the UK have seen a fairly consistent rise in recent numbers in the number of immigrants coming to live and work in these two countries. Do you think then this survey bears out the feeling that immigration is a threat to our national identity? But do you think also there could be the fact that there have been, particularly in Italy, some controversial laws passed recently against illegal immigration that many people claim will fuel racism and that will help to encourage a feeling of insecurity and fear when it comes to the immigrant?
Well, I think there are a lot of interesting questions there, and this conference doesn't pretend to find any simple answers. The fact is there aren't any simple answers. I think what the survey shows is that for young British people, the main threat that they see from mass immigration is a threat to jobs, whereas in Italy, in Italian minds, and I think we saw this in the election campaign, unregulated immigration is linked very firmly in people's minds with security, and that has led to the government taking a number of measures. But I think this is a very interesting area, and again, a very interesting topic of debate this year at Pontignano, because there is a dilemma. Both our countries, both our economies need a large flow of immigrants because we both have shrinking populations. But at the same time, we are wrestling with the dilemma of when people come from other countries, other cultures, to what extent should they be encouraged to integrate, or to what extent should we construct our societies in a way which fully respects their different values, religions and identities? That's the interesting dilemma. And as I say, there's no simple answer.
When it comes to the question of religion, of course, there is the fact that very often these immigrants
don't share the same religion as the people in the host country. We think about the influx of Muslims. Do you think that tends to make people fear them more because they don't share the same religion? They see them then as more of a threat?
I don't think the survey supports the idea that religion in any respect is a hugely important factor in their feeling of national identity. Religion comes rather low down the list. So I think it's a wider question than religion. It's to do with culture. And the question is, to what extent someone coming from outside should somehow be expected to adopt the values and so on of the host nation. The fact is, in Britain now, we have a multicultural society, but it's one in which people do worry about the degrees of integration, and that goes into a lot of different policies to do with education, for example. As I say, there are no simple answers.
And what do young people think are the most important values for the future?
Well, I don't know whether they think in terms of values for the future. The things that they worry about are whether the economic challenges that come from globalization, whether the security threats from terrorism, whether the threats from climate change and so on can be addressed. They have to be addressed, they recognize, by collective action, and it's collective action not at the level of a single state, but the collective action of Europe and more widely.
How important do you feel that the role of Christianity is in Europe in helping to promote peaceful coexistence among, as you say, this increasingly multicultural and multi-ethnic society, namely, shall we say, that Christian duty to welcome the stranger in our midst?
Yes, I think that's hugely important. I think the churches in both our countries do have an important role in reminding people of our Christian heritage and of the values that go with it, and the way that those values are translated into how you treat outsiders. And as I said earlier, these are outsiders which our economy needs, and so we should be welcoming them in. Of course, there are challenges, but there are challenges that can only be properly addressed if we hold close to the values that our religions teach us. That doesn't mean that Christianity is the only religion, of course, that is valid. We need to recognise the values that Muslims and others have, and they're very similar, in fact. I mean, I've spent a lot of my time in the Islamic world, and there's no reason, as we have seen throughout history, why Christians and Muslims can't live perfectly peacefully alongside each other, respecting each other's religions and values.
So when it comes to Europe's Christian roots, do you feel that these in some ways should still be considered the building blocks of this continent? You remember that when there was came to writing the European Constitution, there was a very strong move by the churches, particularly the Catholic Church, for this reference, which wasn't actually in the end incorporated.
I think most people in our societies want to and have no trouble in recognising the Christian roots of their culture. But that doesn't mean to say that it's the only factor when you're describing the religious or other makeup of your society. I don't think, as I say, if you look at the results of the opinion poll, I don't think religion as such is something that really worries young people in either Italy or the UK at the moment.
Nonetheless, both societies, of course, are seeing increasing secularism. Do you think that is a threat?
I think it's a fact. We just have to take account of it. But that doesn't mean that, I mean, it depends how you define secularism. I mean, falling attendance at church doesn't mean that people are necessarily moving away from what some of us would describe as Christian values. Perhaps there are many other ways of propagating Christian belief and Christian values. You don't just have to measure it by attendance in the formal ceremonies that the church has.
Coming to the relationship between Europe and America, do you think there has been a shift in this relationship? I mean, many people see that, as I say, there is an increasing cultural divergence because, as you say, Europe is going down the path of growing secularism, whilst in the US there's still a strong sense of religion.
Yes, I think that is an important difference. I think the rise of the sort of Christian fundamentalist right is a factor that has affected US policy, and it's not a phenomenon on the whole that one sees in Europe. But I think that's a relatively minor factor compared to all the common values and common interests that both sides of the Atlantic have and will continue to have for the foreseeable future.
The Pontignano Conference was co-chaired by Chris Patton, former EU Commissioner and now Chancellor of the University of Oxford. A practicing Catholic, Patton spells out what role he believes the Church should play in today's society.
I think that a vital role of the churches is to encourage respect between different groups, is to help different groups to live tolerantly side by side. I think at the intellectual level, interfaith dialogue is extremely important. Maybe it's even more crucial to have churches, parishes working at the grassroots to promote better relations between different groups. It's complicated by the fact, I think, that in Britain, for example, a large amount of church attendance in some parts of the country is migrant groups, is Poles, is Filipinas and so on, who make up a large part of the congregation in some of our churches.
That was Chris Patton, Chancellor of the University of Oxford and former EU Commissioner. And earlier you heard the voice of Edward Chaplin, British Ambassador to Italy. During his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict continued his catechesis on the teachings of St. Paul the Apostle. Chris Altieri reports.
Thousands of pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square to participate in Pope Benedict XVI's weekly General Audience, during which the Pope concentrated on two particular events that illustrate Paul's relationship to the 12 apostles, saying the episodes show how Paul combined respect for their authority with frankness in the service of the gospel.
As a council of Jerusalem, Paul defended before the 12 his conviction that the grace of Christ had freed the Gentiles from the obligations of the Mosaic law. Significantly, the Church's decision in this matter of faith was accompanied by a gesture of concrete concern for the needs of the poor.
Pope Benedict said that by endorsing Paul's collections among the Gentiles, the Council thus set its teaching on Christian freedom within the context of the Church's communion in charity. Pope Benedict went on to remember another episode in which Paul's example showed the Christian vocation to service as an expression of authentic human freedom in Christ.
Later, in Antioch, when Peter, to avoid scandalizing Jewish Christians, abstained from eating with the Gentiles, Paul rebuked him for compromising the freedom brought by Christ. Yet, writing to the Romans years later, Paul himself insisted that our freedom in Christ must not become a source of scandal for others. Paul's example shows us that led by the Spirit and within the communion of the Church, Christians are called to live in a freedom which finds its highest expression in service to others.
At the end of the audience, Pope Benedict saluted pilgrims in many languages, including English.
I offer a warm welcome to the new students of the Pontifical Irish College. May your priestly formation in the Eternal City prepare you to be generous and faithful servants of God's people in your native land. I also greet the missionary sisters of the Society of Mary on the occasion of the General Chapter. Upon all the English-speaking pilgrims, especially those from Ireland, Australia, Japan, Hong Kong, South Korea, Trinidad and Tobago, Canada and the United States, and for God's abundance, blessings.
Chris Altieri reporting there. And that's all from us here at the English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.com. Laudato Jesus Christus.